Welcome to Cartridge Command, your weekly retro gaming podcast where we discuss and review the classic
and not so classic games of the 8 and 16-bit era. I'm Nick.
And I'm Dale.
And this week's game is Shadowrun for the Sega Genesis, Part 1.
That's right. We're finally completing our patron request from Radiant Blur so long ago, who inspired us, requested us to review both releases of the Shadowrun game. And so now we're here to do it on the Sega Genesis. So
thank you, sir. Thank you for doing those Gunderson runs and saving up your new yen and having us play these wonderful games, my friend.
That's right. We're going to make it worth your while. So Shadowrun was released for the Sega Genesis in 1994. I specifically say Genesis because I'm not sure. It only came out in North America, Philippines, and Taiwan. So I'm not sure if it would have been Mega Drive there or in those two countries. But those were very specific release information that I saw. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, Mega Drive was just Japan, right?
I thought
or was that a Europe thing as well.
I know it's Europe as well, but I don't know if the Genesis made it. You know what I mean? Like overseas, yeah. Or if that was just the American or North American release. I don't know, but
the Philippines and Taiwan, though, huh? Weird spread.
Pretty wild. But this game was designed by Blue Sky Software, which is an American development studio, and they mostly did some games. Kind of starting very late 80s, early 90s, some Atari 7800 games, you know, Atari Lynx and some other things. And then kind of various Sega systems, Master System, Game Gear, Genesis, 32X.
Yeah, these guys did Ren and Stimpy on the Genesis.
Yeah. And Vector Man and Jurassic Park, which we did play on the podcast. So
go check it out, fans.
Pretty cool stuff, but that's about... They closed in, I think, 2001. So I think they had one or two games on the PlayStation maybe and then called it quits. So,
oh, bummer, man. Let's bring them back. Let's make another Shadowrun.
Blue Sky 2 coming at you. All right, so Dale, what kind of game is Shadowrun for the Sega Genesis?
Shadowrun for the Sega Genesis is a top-down, third-person action RPG based off the tabletop series.
That's right. It's, well, the same name and setting as the Super Nintendo one. This is a very different beast, much more of an RPG, I would say.
I would agree. There's a lot more layers in this onion, that's for sure.
That's right. And while it does have a story, you kind of pursue it at your leisure here. It's a very much more an open world experience than the other one.
I would agree. A lot less linear. There's a lot of different ways you can attack this game. You're really free to do whatever you want, but you will be grinding, just so you know.
That's right. Oh, yeah. So this game uses a similar, you know, some of the stuff is similar to the Super Nintendo version where you have stats that are similar, but it feels like there's just kind of a truncated version copied from the tabletop RPG. You know, you got a little mini version of that on the Super Nintendo, but here seems pretty faithful. I think they crammed a lot and kind of towed the line very closely to the actual game, at least to my somewhat limited experience.
I would agree. They definitely added a ton more stats and attributes, skills, things you can level up. Yeah, a lot more freedom to spec your character the way that you want to play your character. And you also have three different classes you can choose from starting the game out, which is a big change from the SNES counterpart.
That's right. And you have the three classes are your Street Samurai, which is your fighter, basically. Or you can play as a Decker, where you're the... You know, you specialize in using your cyber decks to infiltrate the Matrix. And finally, the Shaman, which is the spellcaster, all of which are pretty cool, I guess. We'll talk more about the classes as we go, but I think we can talk a quick bit about the different attributes that we have.
Let's do it.
Because yes, you have 8 of them, and then you have a ton of skills as well that we'll briefly talk about in a minute here. But as far as your attributes go. You have your body, which is interesting because most RPGs, you know, would have hit points or something to indicate your health. But here you have physical and mental kind of, I don't know if they're called stamina or whatever. They're just a percentage. You know, it's always on like 100%, 90%, 80, you know. So it's kind of like only having 10 hit points. It's a little strange.
And yeah,
you can increase your survivability by increasing your body attribute, which as a human, all of your stats max out at 6. These are all raised by spending karma points. So it's not like you level up and all your stats go up. It's like you accumulate karma and spend it bit by bit and slowly raise various stats and or attributes.
Yep, the world's your oyster. You can do whatever you want with that karma. You could put them all into magic if you want and nothing else.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool. And as we'll get into later, there's a lot of different rewards and interesting ways that those stats and skills combine to influence different things. And you can incrementally increase them. You mostly gain karma by just going on shadow runs. This isn't a game where you kind of get it for killing people. I don't know. I've seen weird estimates between 10 to 20 kills will get you like a karma point. So it's, which oh, really? Is not very,
it felt like I was getting more, but I read in the manual that the three ways you get karma are advancing the story, killing people, and doing runs. So I guess while advancing the story and killing people, I thought I was getting more for just capping thugs in the street. But if it takes 20, maybe not.
I don't know. I did a lot of certain runs will require you to kill a bunch of ghouls. We'll have more info on that later. And
oh, yeah.
I was always killing 20 at a time, and I would come out and check my karma, and I would have one, sometimes two more than I would have gotten from the run. So it's somewhere up there. I don't know. But yeah, so as you accumulate your karma and spend it, you can use body, which doesn't increase your hit points, but makes it harder to damage you. It's an interesting way that this Shadowrun, not just the games, but the tabletop RPG itself, where it's less about getting more hit points. It's more about taking less damage by just getting tougher through various means.
Exactly. Just like real life too, man. You work on that body, get a little tougher, take more damage.
That's right. Yeah. Work on that body. Your next stat is quickness, which is pretty self-explanatory. It's very useful because when you get into combat, the higher your quickness, the sooner you can attack a second or third or, you know, each time.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue, Nick, that body and quickness are two of your early things you want to pump some karma into if you want to make this game a little easier on you.
I would agree 100%. Now, a little less useful here is strength, unless you're doing a melee combat kind of build, which you can. That will improve your damage there. And again, maxes out at 6, not too bad. A sleeper hit here for me is charisma. You get the riz, and you get the higher this goes, it will influence certain things like
primarily your hiring price for Shadowrunners, right? So you can get more people on your team for cheaper.
Well, yeah, and that's as you hire Shadowrunners, their price not only factors in charisma, but it's also your reputation and negotiation stat, and how many runs you've had with them in the past. The more you hire them, their price will go down to a certain level.
Oh, really? That's cool. I didn't know that.
It's pretty wild, but it's also very important if you get stopped by guards when you're infiltrating a corporation, you either need a fake ID or you can try to talk your way out of it. And I found with a 6 charisma, you could talk your way out of it probably at least half the time, maybe 2/3 of the time.
Without you silver tongue devil, you.
Well, I don't want to hear that damn alarm, so.
Yeah. What is interesting, real quick, as we're going through these attributes, is that how they kind of play with each other, and there's sort of like a hidden system, as I understand it. For instance, if we're talking about quickness, determining your movement and your attack speed, mm-hmm. coupling that with your intelligence, which determines attack speed, plus your combat success, I guess the two of those together as an aggregate will overall raise your combat effectiveness and speed. There's some math going on there they don't really tell you about.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And like you said, intelligence is our next attribute there, which for the most part, it's your attack speed, I think, as well as success for cyber combat in the Matrix.
Ah, the Matrix. Yep.
And then you also have willpower as a stat that will... That's more for spellcasting. It helps determine success. And I believe it also can affect your resistance to some spell magic effects and stuff.
That makes sense because this is essentially a useless stat unless you start the game as a shaman, right? But unless there's resistance there, if you come up against a heavy magic user in this game and you need some more defense, this is one to avoid. Again, unless you're a shaman.
Not a very good, not that important, yeah, like you said, for most of us. Next we have Essence, which is, it's a weird attribute because you always start with six and it decreases by getting cyberware. It's kind of like your natural, I don't know, magical soul or whatever, and getting cyberware hacks it down each... We'll talk about cyberware later, but in short, each type of cyberware you get has an essence cost associated with it, so you can only get so much.
This is a super interesting stat, and I think it's kind of strange that it's in attributes. I feel like essence should kind of sit in its own little spot in the menu, because it's not something that you really pump karma into. It's something that you keep an eye on as you purchase your cyberware, which is a cool system in the game, because it's you're kind of fighting... fighting against, you know, magic versus cyberware. And as one increases, you may lose the other.
Yeah, it's, you know, for this game's purposes, it's generally like if you're a samurai or a decker, you want to get all the cyberware you can. And it's more about how are you spending your essence. But, and then, of course, you want to avoid using any of it if you're a shaman. But in the tabletop RPG, I believe, there's more than just the three classes. And there are some that are kind of in between where you have like adepts that are like fighter shamans or different, and you could kind of weasel your way into that here, but
that was something I was going to mention too. I kind of wish there was a fourth class that was a cross between like a shaman and a fighter, or maybe even a fifth class too. But
sure, yeah, there are definitely more in the pen and paper game, but here it's like you pick your three kind of starting points, and from there you can make a shaman where you're like half and half. You could, you know, keep some essence and maybe get a couple things of cyberware. I guess I don't know how worthwhile it is, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm looking at the game right now. Okay, so it's, I got a magic is your final attribute, which is what you think it is. It just determines the maximum force of spell casting and decreases when you got more cyberware installed. Again, kind of that play between magic and cyberware.
Which, you know, is interesting because when you're casting spells, you get to, when you like equip a spell, kind of, you get to set the amount of force you want it to use. So.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea.
The higher your magic stat is, the higher you can do that, you know.
Spoiler alert, I did not play as a shaman for my first playthrough. I was a samurai, so I have not touched magic.
Yeah, I'm still experimenting with the magic as we speak, but more about that later. Now, when you raise your attributes with karma, it's, I think, the same as in the Super Nintendo, where the cost is, let's say you have a 3 strength and you want to increase it to 4. Well, the cost would be 4 points of karma.
Indeed. It keeps doubling over every time.
Yeah. And now the skills, on the other hand, while you have many more of them, they're more expensive, where if you want to go from, say, 3 sorcery to 4 sorcery, then it's, instead of costing 4, it costs 8. It's twice as much as your however high you are raising it, or the target number that you're going for, I guess.
Exactly. And the skills, we've got a lot of skills that we can play around with here. And I think this is where a lot of that customization comes in. I mean, we've got sorcery, we've got firearms, which determines all guns, but then it breaks down into pistols, SMGs, and shotguns as separate stats that you can buff up. And then you got your melee. There's skill. Yep.
Well, one thing about those, the pistols, you know, the firearms thing is pretty interesting, because like if you have a 4 firearms and 0 in the others, you will essentially have a 4 when you're raising your stats. But when you only raise the pistols, SMGs, or shotguns, then those are actually cheaper to raise than your base firearm stat.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't notice that.
It only increases your attack effectiveness and stuff for those specific types of weapons. However, it's also, if you go, you can do a weird jump where, like, if you get your firearms to 10 and then you raise your pistols, for the cost to raise it, it's like it'll just cost you like 11 points to raise it from 0 to 11.
Oh, okay.
And you won't have to go through all those steps. It's kind of weird. I just stuck with firearms for the most part, and then towards the end of the game, when I had a bunch of extra karma, I was just like, well, I might as well get a 13 shotguns just in case. Or
yeah, that does make sense in a lot of ways, though, because firearms cost a lot to raise. It's you need to grind for a lot of karma to raise firearms even once. So having the option to break it out into pistols, shotguns, or SMGs is nice.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to bust in there, but
No, you're good, man. Bustin' whenever you want.
We also have...
additionally, for our skills, we've got throwing, computer. Computer is interesting because this is what will increase your success rate when you're in doing your cyber combat in the Matrix.
Yes, it's very important for your decker, whether that be you or someone you hire.
Oh, yeah. And you're going to want to raise this up, too, if you're trying to make any kind of money in this game, which we'll get to later on.
Oh, yeah.
Right after that, we've got our biotech, which is basically our healing skill. It determines, I guess, how much health you get back from medkits.
Yeah, it's pretty useful early on, especially because two of your non-magical, anyways, means of healing are you get like stim patches, which give you a set percentage of your health back, and the medkit, it gives you a percentage that depends on your biotech stats. So the higher, the better for healing. I chose to max out one of my runners where I was like, might as well just have them do all my medkitting, and it was pretty useful.
Smart. Got a healer on the team.
Yeah.
Right after biotech, we're looking at electronics, which is determines our success when attempting to force open a maglock, which I have not come across yet.
Oh, this is a very important skill, I think, because it will not, you know, you can purchase a electronics kit kind of that you can use for a couple things. One of which is like opening maglocks, which are all over inside corporate headquarters where a lot of later corporation runs where will take place. And you can use them at these kind of computer terminals you'll see inside to shut off cameras and alarms so that they won't send troops at you. And if the alarm does go off, you can just go back and shut them down. And the success depends on your electronics generally. I think out of 5 or 6, you can usually pull it off pretty easily. And if you ever fail, you can keep just going back to that terminal and trying again.
This is one I need to start putting points in. Spoiler alert for the listeners out there. As of the recording of this episode, I'm still working through my first playthrough. I think Nick is on his second. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay. This is a long game, and I've been chipping away at it piece by piece. By the time we're done with this, obviously I'll be done with it. But at this point in the game, this is where I need that electronic skill, and I've put nothing into it. So
it's worth, you know, getting as well, because you can also, once you get to 5 or 6, you have a pretty solid chance at opening the locks, because the alternative is there are ways you can find, you can buy a maglock. Like there are 5 levels of maglock essentially, and a level 5 will open all of them. A level 5 maglock key that you can buy, and it costs like $20,000.
Yeah, they're expensive. I definitely can't afford that yet either.
I did a lot of grinding to afford one, and I don't think it was worth it, because if you can just use your electronics, I don't know, because you're going to need it anyways to infiltrate these places. You need it to shut down those alarms. Otherwise, you're in for a long, slow, frustrating run. Even if you can make it through, it just gets boring, like killing these guards constantly and waiting and listening to this alarm going off in this building. So,
This game will beat you into the ground. It has no qualms about doing that. But one of the cool things about the game is, as you were saying, there's typically a lot of different ways you can approach different missions. But moving on through our skills, next up after electronics is our reputation, our rep, man.
Yeah.
This is going to determine our overall notoriety, so which really affects what, Nick?
Not a whole lot. basically, it does, or is one of the things that affects your Shadowrunner price, as well as there are certain clubs and places you go to talk to certain people and stuff that will either not let you in unless you have a certain amount of reputation, or charge you money unless you have a certain destination. Like there's the Club Penumbra, right? And if you don't have an elf in your party, you can just come right in, but if you don't, then they won't let you in unless you have a 5 reputation or certain various gangs. It's like you can go meet with their leader if you go to their headquarters, but they'll charge you money if you don't have 4 or 5 reputation. I think I got mine up to 5 or 6. When I played through, and beyond that, like I don't know what a 12, you know, all of these max out at 12 or 13 in the case of those special firearms skills, but I don't know that it's worth getting much more or what it would do for you, I guess. I don't know.
Gosh, I didn't know the bit about having an elf in your party, because right now they won't let me in because I don't have a reputation of 6 to the Penumbra Club.
Oh, yeah, so. Yeah. If you have a couple, you know, there are a couple elven Shadowrunners, so you just get one of them in your party and roll in.
Heck yeah, man. You got coops.
Yeah.
All right, next up after reputation is negotiation, which will increase how much you're getting paid for your shadow runs, and also I think cut down on some prices in the stores too when you're picking up equipment.
It absolutely does. It's a great skill. One of the first ones I leveled up because, you know, you'll go from any time you accept a shadow run, which we'll get into a little more detail later, the negotiation kind of kicks in. There's essentially an off-screen dice roll between you and the Johnson, you know, putting you on this run. So, and you'll see, it'll be like the reward for this run is 45 new yen, but after negotiating, you get it up to 55 or 60, or as you get it up to, I raised mine to 6, and then much later kind of started increasing it as I started to go after some very expensive equipment in the late game. But early on, it does a lot for you, especially if you're doing repeated easy runs, because it can almost double the amount of money you get.
I 100% agree. That was one of three of my early game things I pumped karma into: negotiation, body, and quickness. I try to get those up as fast as I could to try to make that early game a little bit easier, because it can be kind of brutal starting out.
Oh, very much so. So it's a big help, and it also influences how much you get when you sell equipment. So that can help a little bit at the beginning when you kill the very few times you just get into random battles with like gang members and stuff, they will sometimes drop med kits and stuff, and selling those, it can help you early on, because they're worth like 100 new yen, and that means something at the very beginning.
Oh yeah, that's a gold mine at the beginning of the game, especially when certain milk runs you're doing will only net you 10 or 20 new yen. Somebody randomly dropping a med kit for 100 is like, oh, thank you.
Yes, yeah, I mean, it's a real windfall.
And that is all of our skills.
So yeah, you'll level those up as you earn karma, and you can only do that when you sleep in a hotel, and you can go to a karma screen and upgrade, spend it away. One thing that's interesting is that, you know, there's a cast of, I don't know, 10 or 12 shadow runners who we'll meet later, but they all have their own karma, and that they will accumulate as they go on runs with you. And it's permanent, as well as all their equipment. It's interesting because they're kind of like all your characters that you just get in your party at times, because you can totally change their equipment, any of their runs. You can buy them cyberware if they have the essence to spend. You can change, you know, you level them up according to however you want. They won't level up on their own at all. But if you just keep using the same person for runs, in addition to charging you less, you can kind of craft them into what you want for your party.
That's interesting. And I guess it, for me at least, begs the question, I guess it would be smart then to stick with the same team of Shadowrunners, because you're sort of building up your quote unquote party at that point, right? Because I mean, if you keep spreading it around, these people are expensive. You're going to run out of money. And if you're not leveling up the same people, then how effective are they going to be towards the end of the game?
Right. Well, and, you know, in the beginning third of the game, you know, the money is very tight, but that goes away very quickly. And then there are certain things that, you know, like the Shadowrunners, you know, early on for one run, it'll be 400 or 500, which seems exorbitant. And then typically the price for you can hire them permanently is like 10 times the amount of a normal run. So it'd be like 4,000 or 5,000, and then they'll just stick with you forever, which is not, I guess unless they die, you might have to rehire them. I'm not sure, but it becomes much more affordable later in the game when you can start doing runs that you'll get like 1,000 to 2,000 to 4,000 for a medium level run, as opposed to doing low level ones like you kind of have to at the beginning.
Gotcha.
So let's talk a little bit about combat real quick, because I like the way they do it in this game in certain ways, where you will just be on your screen walking around, and then here come some gang members trying to kill you, and kill you they will at the very beginning. But I like that you have your A button, which you can just hold down to attack. The game will automatically target someone, and your character will just start either firing their gun or casting their spell or whatever you have equipped. And it just kind of was what I wanted the other Shadowrun to do, because you can just kind of toggle through your targets by hitting B and changing to the right person. And you just hold down A and you'll auto attack as fast as your stats will allow you to.
Yeah, the combat in this game is certainly an upgrade from the SNES counterpart. However, it's not quite perfect. There was many times where if you don't raise your quickness enough, that early game, at least, I guess for the first third of the game, that if you get into engagement you don't want to get into, A, you can't stop and save the game. So if you didn't already save your game, you might get beat up, man, and have to go to the hospital. And every time you go to the hospital, you're losing 10% of your money right there. So sometimes people jump you and you don't want to fight. I just want to get past this. I want to get to where I'm going. I don't want to attack you guys. I'm running out of bullets, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And they'll just catch up to you and just beat the snot out of you. And that's that.
It's rough. It means the first chunk of the game is grinding for karma and money to spend on like armor or other, or, you know, some cheaper cyberware to just increase your survivability. But typically, at least once you start getting some decent stuff, it becomes the battles I've found have become kind of, at least in the early, where you're like, okay, now I've got my armor jacket and some dermal plating, and you're just, it's like you still suck at fighting, but they can't hurt you very well. So you're both just kind of like slapping each other. Slowly, eventually they die.
I will say that while combat is kind of stiff, there is a little bit of a strategy to how you move around the screen. When I first started playing this, I was just getting destroyed over and over again, primarily because whenever I got into a fight, I would just stop and mash the attack button, sort of assuming that on the back end, this is all handled by a dice roll, essentially, which is, you know, do you hit? Do you miss? You know, how much damage is it going to do? And try to kill the other guy before he kills you, obviously. Yeah. However, there is sort of a system of evasion where if somebody's coming at you and you run in certain diagonals and you kind of bait out a punch, they'll stop and throw a punch and you can get, you know, 5 or 6 steps away and start taking a few shots and rinse and repeat. So
yeah, it's interesting. You cannot, speaking of movement, you cannot really run away from fights, I guess, in theory, if you're fast enough, or
if they're far enough off the screen, you can get away sometimes. But if they're, you know, within a few feet away, you're stuck in that fight.
You kind of, the game slows down a bit, your movement slows and you kind of go into combat mode, and you know the enemies are slow too, but they can move almost as fast or just as fast as you. And because there have been times where I was like, I have no hope, I'm just trying to run and they will not give up, you know, it's like, oh god. And you know, I kited this guy, you know, all around the Redmond Barrens, just, you know, almost dead, just begging for, because you can't go indoors or anything, yeah, to get away from them.
You were stuck fighting them, man. That's your only destiny at that point in the game. And I was texting you a few times as I first started playing this game, because my initial reaction was sort of negative when I started this game, primarily because of the combat system, which I've since adapted to and grown to enjoy a little bit more. But early game, dude, like, it's just, I'm trying to go fetch some stuff for some people. That's it. Leave me alone. Stop beating me up in the alleys. What did I do to you? Like, people just jump out and there's nothing you can do. They just destroy you.
They are ruthless.
They are indeed.
So, yeah, and at the beginning, you don't start with great equipment. You typically start with some sort of gun, or depending on, you know, if you're a samurai, you start with, I think, you have hand razors, you know, to for your melee attack and stuff. But I didn't really get into much melee. But, it's there if you want to go that route. It is effective.
Yeah, I was forced to use some melee in the beginning of the game because I ran out of bullets and I had no idea where to get ammo at, which also costs money. So up until then, I was using those hand razors, which are actually considered cyberware, right?
Yeah. Most like, depending on what class you are, determines if you have them or not. Like, I don't think shamans do, but I know samurai start with them. You can later upgrade them. It's, you know, with your cyberware. But as far as the weapons go, you have, you know, basically it's just those two melee options, and you'll have, much like the skills might indicate to the astute listener, pistols, submachine guns, and shotguns. And pistols are kind of the best on ammo in a way, because you'll get one shot per one unit of, you know, you, all of your ammunition are in universal clips. So, and if you can have, let's say your pistol holds 12 shots, then, you know, you'll get one bullet per shot. But whereas with a submachine gun, it's like, it will shoot 3 bullets. It'll have a higher ammo. It'll say like 24, but it's really only 8 shots, because every time you effectively shoot it, you're using 3 bullets.
Yeah, at this point in the game, I've only used pistols, and I think I might stick with pistols till end game, at least. I've heard shotguns can be pretty effective, especially if you deck out the whole team with them, with some heavy armor as well, be the shotgun boys.
But, sure, yeah.
I've also seen quite a few people that are just pistol users exclusively. They go straight for the Predator and run with it till end game.
That's kind of what I did, but the difference is that The weapons don't just do damage. They have a power rating and a damage rating. And you want the higher power is more important in a way than the actual damage, because that determines how much of their armor rating and body rating it will penetrate, kind of. So you'll actually do more damage from a high power, medium damage pistol, or I don't know. It's just a better buy or a more effective buy, especially in the first like half of the game. Later, when you start getting a lot more money, you can purchase the more expensive, higher end, say, machine guns or shotguns to really put the killing on people if you need. But I found by that point, it didn't really matter.
I guess while we're talking about combat and weapons, now's as good a time as ever to talk a little bit about the posture slider that we have in this game as well. So yeah. Your character, Joshua, you also have just a standard base attack and defense rating, which is right in your main menu that you can see at all times. And there's a posture slider, which I don't know if I've seen in another game, where you can, on the fly, change your character from full defense, medium defense, neutral, to medium offense, and full offense. So
yeah, it's pretty cool because it will adjust your stats slightly to reflect your, you know, whether you're going all out for guns or just trying to stay alive, which is fun. But it also kind of doubles because you can adjust it on your shadow runners as well. So that will kind of control their AI a bit, or adjust it a little how they behave in combat. So that's pretty fun. And that's not the only thing with posture. We'll get into it later. But Magic and the Matrix cyber combat also have postures.
No kidding. Okay.
Which took me a long time to figure out. But you can also get various armor, which is pretty interesting because, you know, with, you know, like how I was describing the power ratings of weapons, this is the opposite of that, where various types of armor will have various higher defense against weapons and guns. So some of them are better, you know, they're usually pretty close to each other, but like an armor vest will basically protect you from like 1 point of weapon damage or 2 points of gun damage.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's I guess you could theoretically hot swap these on the fly depending on what area of the game that you're in.
Yeah, it doesn't really lend us. This is a pretty linear, you know, unlike the weapons, there's just like you start with crappy armor and they just all get slightly better at kind of proportionate price points.
Yeah.
And then finally, we also talk a little bit about our cyberware.
Oh, yeah, the cyberware. Expensive stuff.
Absolutely, especially at first. Like I said, there's a mid-game kind of you start making a lot more money, but at the very beginning, if you want to get cyberware, because you can buy some right in the very starting area, but it is in thousands typically of dollars or new yen for the various things that, you know, they all have a new yen cost as well as an essence cost, so we can get into it here.
So we've got 8 total different pieces of cyberware that we're going to come across in this excellent game.
Yeah, baby.
And the first one of the most important things you can get is your data jack. So, and this bad boy is going to allow you to input and output from any cyber deck, and it's required to enter the Matrix.
That's right. I personally didn't get one because, you know, it depends on how you decide if you want to be the decker or you want to hire a decker, you know?
Gotcha.
Because you can do it. It only has an essence cost of 0.2 out of, you know, your 6 essence. So it's effectively pretty cheap, and it doesn't cost a lot relative to other cyberware.
I think it's the cheapest cyberware you can get in the game. And I picked one up just because I had no idea how much a decker was going to cost me, or if I would have the money to do that. And I wanted to have the ability to potentially look at some of these Matrix runs early on to start making some serious guap.
Absolutely. And you can. It's not it's so cheap that it can be worth it to, because you can get in there and get that money if you don't want to save up to pay that first, you know, if you try to milk one poor Shadowrunner decker to make them pay for it. And one thing about these is I'm kind of vaguely talking about the prices of things because, you know, there are 5 different areas, places you can buy cyberware, and all cyberware costs different at the different stores and is also different depending on how much where your negotiation skill is at.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite things about this game that really lends itself to a lot of replayability, because there can be huge jumps in the prices of certain cyberware. For instance, one of the last things you can get, or one of the most expensive things, I should say, is the wired reflexes, which we'll talk a little bit about. But at most expensive, you're paying $40,000 for this thing, but you can find it for $20,000, literally half the price, if you just go to another area. So it's important to shop around for your cyberware.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's I don't know. It's a fun, cool little detail, I think.
But next up, we've got our cyber eyes, which essentially looks like a pair of red sunglasses. It's going to cost us 0.2 essence, and it augments your vision to counter invisibility and increase combat effectiveness, which, Nick, I have not encountered anyone invisible yet. I have not been invisible myself, so I have not purchased these.
The thing with cyber eyes is that there's another... They're kind of like an alternative to a smart link, which you can get either of them, or I think you could technically have both at the same time. But so you can use this to see invisibility, but as far as increasing your combat effectiveness, it's kind of minor, because you can also, you get a smart link later that you can use because to hook into your weapons, because you can also modify your various guns. And I think with the exception of shotguns, I don't think you can, but most of them have like a smart gun option that you can increase on them, and then you can use the smart link.
Gotcha.
Or you can use smart goggles if you don't have the smart link, but it's not this, it's not as good. I don't know. It's interesting. But cyber eyes, I guess, are useful for invisibility. I had them. I only saw a few. I would see some invisible things because they just look like, kind of like a predator blur moving around, but you can still attack them. So I don't know.
I see. Maybe this would be more effective for a shaman run, or someone, you know, a spellcaster.
Well, and to be fair, most of the time I saw invisible creatures was in the wilderness. So
Okay. Well, moving on, next up, we've got the hand raisers, which, as we mentioned before, you typically come with if you're a decker or a samurai. Mm-hmm. And those point one essence doesn't really cost you a lot of essence to wield these bad boys. And these are basically exactly what they sound like. They're sharp chrome steel blades that slide under your synthetic fingernails.
Ooh, yeah, they're... You can use your killer nails. So they're nice to have, I guess, but if you don't start with it, I probably wouldn't mess with them, you know?
I will say melee combat is surprisingly effective. The few fist fights I got into when I had no ammo, I managed to come out on top. So you can do some decent damage just with your hand razors.
There are certain shadow runners that are very well suited to it, you know?
You can make like a monk, so to speak, monk class.
You absolutely can. And which is cool. Save you some money, man, instead of dumping all that stuff into guns. But
well, if you're trying to level your monk up and do a little more damage, this next piece of cyberware will help you out, which is the spurs, which essentially just looks like longer hand razors. It'll cost you 0.2 essence, and just another set of carbon fiber blades that go on the back of your hand for punching people out.
Yeah, they're just stronger than the and better than the hand razors. It's interesting. They have an interesting thing with their essence cost, because if you have the hand razors, which cost 0.1, you can upgrade to spurs for an additional 0.1. Or if you're going from nothing to spurs, it's a 0.2 essence. So not too bad.
Not bad at all. And real quick, while we're on the topic, when you purchase this cyberware and you commit these items to essence, is there a way to get rid of them? Because I couldn't find a way in the menu.
Pretty sure there's not. Yeah, I think you're stuck with it. So you want to be careful.
So it's a hard commitment then. If you're trying to save your essence, you really got to think about what you want to purchase here, because you're stuck with it.
Yep. You want to have a plan if possible.
All right. Well, moving on, the aforementioned smart link, it's going to cost you 0.5 essence. And the official effect of this thing is it's the feedback circuitry needed to use combat information provided by a smart gun.
Which is pretty cool. I had one of these. I enjoyed it. I think, you know, you can get the same effect by buying smart goggles, but that eats up a spot in your inventory, which you only have 8 slots in each character's inventory. So that's kind of rough.
Brutal. Can you expand that at all? No items or anything to open that up a little bit?
No, you can't. So that's another benefit of having Shadowrunners, is they give you the extra slots. So
all right, moving on. We've got the muscle replacement. It's going to cost you 1 whole essence. Ooh, that's expensive. Implanted synthetic muscles, which increase both strength and quickness. So I guess this thing would sort of go hand in hand with your spurs or your hand raisers if you're trying to box people up. Because that strength stat is really just fist to fist, right?
Yeah, yeah. I got some for the quickness, of course. It's pretty cool. Worth it, I think.
Duly noted. Moving on, we've got the dermal plating, which I just purchased recently, which I think is highly worth it. This bad boy is going to cost you 0.5 essence, and it's a hard plastic and metal fiber plate, which are bonded to your flesh to form armor.
So metal.
Very metal.
And definitely worth it. It's one of the little more affordable, you know, you're in the 2,000 to 3,000 or less kind of range. So a little, one of the first ones I could afford. And each point you get in it makes you a little tougher and harder to kill. And you're going to need that.
Definitely going to need that, especially early game. And this bad boy too, you can find this at its cheapest rate fairly early in the game. Once you make it to Seattle, the General Hospital will sell it to you for $2,800, which is the cheapest price you're going to get for it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then lastly, we mentioned briefly, are the wired reflexes. So these are going to cost you 2 essence. It's our most expensive essence cost. They are implanted neural boosters and adrenaline stimulators, which increase combat speed.
And worth every penny, man. This is one of the most valuable ones.
And I believe that is it for our cyberware.
Yeah, it's one thing quick about the wired reflexes. There's a weirdness about it. It's essence cost, because I think you have a maximum of 3 of these that you can handle, right? So the first one costs 2 essence, but the second one only costs 1.
Interesting.
And the third one, it's back to 2. So I don't know. I got 2. So I spent half my essence on 2 wired reflexes, and I'll stand behind that purchase.
I might do the same thing.
All right, Dale. We've already mentioned that you're still on your first playthrough, but did you have any previous experience with this game?
That is a negative, Nick. Same thing with the Super Nintendo version. If you guys go back and listen to that episode, that was the first time I had heard of Shadowrun the property, tabletop games, all of it. So likewise, I had never heard of the Genesis versions. This is my first time coming across this.
Okay, right on, right on. I never played this as a youth, so I didn't encounter it when I back then. But in the interim many decades, I have picked this up a couple times because I saw it on various lists, and I was always intrigued because I heard it was, you know, a more of a true RPG, so to speak, than the Super Nintendo version. But I never got far, and I would always forget why. And then, you know, this time I finally, thanks to good old Radiant Blur, kept me going, where I was like, I gotta figure this game out. And, you know, the big takeaway for me was that, like, this game is so brutal at the beginning that every time I would be like, I'm going to play this, and I just kept getting shot to hell and not understand, like, what am I doing wrong? And, you know, it's kind of weird. So
I had the thought many times while playing this that if I would have come across this as a youth, I probably would have hated this game. I probably never would have picked it back up because if you're a kid, man, starting out in this game and you're just getting brutalized over and over again when all you want to do is run around like Contra and just waste guys.
Yeah.
Like it's rough.
Well, it's one of those like rare occasions where I'm like, you know, I actually wouldn't mind an in-game tutorial because, you know, I don't know, just to get you going at the very beginning. But
yeah, as an adult, I can appreciate the difficulty. And I think it, if I'm looking for a cherry on the sundae here, it's kind of lends itself to the world. Like this world is very gritty and very dark. And
sure,
the text is very adult and that sort of thing. So you just getting destroyed in the beginning of the game kind of fits in. It's like if you were walking around in Seattle in 2050, you would actually probably get beat up by a bunch of cybernetic thugs. So
it's a rough town, man. Now, in your more recent playthroughs, how far along are you? You know, we can check in with you from time to time to check your progress, as our listeners will have no doubt surmised, this is but the first part of a multi-part review here.
So I mentioned briefly that this is a longer game. So likewise, you know, obviously it's going to take some hours to put in. So I've been playing this for a couple weeks now, a few hours at a time, a few chunks here and there. And I think I'm about 30% or so through the story, if I had to guess. Mm-hmm. But you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, but this seems like the kind of game that once you get past the initial grind and build your character up to a certain level, the game will start to move a lot quicker in terms of the story.
Oh, it absolutely does. There's a big focus on kind of character generation and crafting as you level yourself up. And that's a big draw for me. So I kind of focused on that for a while as soon as after the initial start kind of area, as I was slowly figuring out things about the game and, you know, did a lot of grinding. So when I was ready to pick up the story again, I was able to kind of just push through it without too much difficulty.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the game is sort of designed that the first third, you're focused on character building and coming up with how you want to play the game, you know, based on how you spend your karma and where you put your money.
Absolutely. You know, I like I said, I have beaten this game at this point, but I'm playing through my second one as a shaman to explore that path a bit. But I found that towards the end, it's you know, it is very empowering to be able to slaughter these people that ruined your day so much, you know, they can't do anything to you and you can just gun them down with no consequences. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it does start to feel very nice when you get to a point where thugs try to jump you and you just turn around and one cap them and keep walking.
Yeah, you can pop them off. All right, so this is going to be our level-by-level section, but like most RPGs, this doesn't have levels. It doesn't even have experience levels, so maybe we should call it something else, but too bad. So here we are, level-by-level, and this game starts you off in one area of Seattle 2050, which it's interesting the way it kind of divides it up, where you have different kind of boroughs or sections of the city that you can travel to between. A few of them are actually connected you can walk to, but most of them you have to take a taxi.
Yes, and there is a map screen that shows all of these areas together when you select them, buying a taxi. And I was trying to figure out if this is semi-geographically accurate, because the names of these places are named after real places. Redmond is a real place, and Washington near Seattle. And it's sort of geographically separated, but I actually pulled up Google Maps and was trying to look at Seattle to see if these things line up the way they're supposed to. And I surmised that they don't.
no Puyallup Barrens or anywhere. No, it's yeah, it's interesting. But in the beginning, we're confined. Well, I guess we should start with there's a kind of intro story to set the scene. You play as Joshua, who sees, I believe the story is that you catch on the news, there's a video or a holopix or whatever of someone taped a Shadowrun in progress where the Shadowrunners were slaughtered. And one of them is your brother, Michael.
Michael, no. Yeah, it was recorded on someone's cyber eye. Someone's got a camera in their eyeball. So,
freaks. And then
Joshua's sitting in his, I think he's in a spaceship. I'm not sure. He's sitting in some kind of vehicle and he sees it on the news and he's got his head in his hands like, oh.
So he comes to Seattle to solve the mystery, like what happened here? And that's kind of where you begin. You're in an area of the city known as Redmond Barrens. And when you start off, you cannot leave this area. Now, typically, you would be able to call a taxi from one of the many vidphone kind of kiosks that are all around the city, kind of like a future phone booth. But if you try to do that at this point, you will not be able to. There are no available taxis or something. So you're stuck here for a few.
Yes, indeed. And I believe, as we start out, the first place we want to look in our investigation for our brother's death is at Stoker's Coffin Motel, right?
That's right. That's your, I believe that's your first lead or whatever. You start off, I think you even start right outside it. You can head in. It's, I believe, Mr. Stoker himself. He's a dwarf, and you can ask him about information, get some clues if you want. There's not a whole lot, I don't think, that he tells you, but he, when you ask him about Michael's stuff, because this was where he was staying, he tells you that you have to pay his outstanding, I guess, bills, rent, for 250 new yen, and you start with none, I believe. So you're just kind of like, all right, well,
yeah, so you're essentially forced to start trying to make some money in the city. That's going to be your first order of business, to try to pay off your brother's debt, which he will suggest that you go speak to a man named Gunderson in the jump house to start finding some work. But while we're on the topic real quick, at this motel, it's interesting how this game handles going indoors to certain areas, because in certain bars that you enter, such as the Jump House, which we'll be headed to shortly, you can actually walk inside. There's an interior and you can speak to people if they're in there. But other areas, as soon as you walk in the door, you're just greeted with text. This is a very text heavy game. It's a lot of writing, a lot of reading.
It's true. It, you know, if you recall in the Super Nintendo Shadowrun, we were always going to clubs, but here it's bars. So, and that's where you kind of, you find your ways to get Shadowruns or the people who will hire you, as well as other Shadowrunners. And those seem to be the only ones that have an actual inside map. I guess, except for when you're doing corporation runs, those actually have huge maps that you have to explore and raid.
It's essentially inside your dungeon that you're navigating through at that point. So
But you're right. Yeah, here's Stoker, and in fact, most of the buildings in this game are just, you come in, you'll see a portrait of someone you're kind of talking to, and that's in a bunch of text. You usually have options to choose from, what you want to ask about, and various things. That's pretty fun.
Also, the art for the portraits is really good. I enjoyed all those. So some of them are creepy too. It's a very, very gritty game.
But It is. There's certain, it's pretty funny. There's certain super repeated ones though. There's like the typical like businessman who's this like weird lumpy guy, and you'll see him with like black hair and tan skin and all these different, you know, they just keep swapping it. And you're just like, I mean, you're going on hundreds of runs probably. So there's like, of course they couldn't handle that many different portraits. So, but it has a certain charm.
Yeah. And then we mentioned this is, you know, a top down game. So we're navigating a city that's basically laid out on a grid. So when not inside these buildings or in these text windows, we're essentially just running through the streets. And you do see people running around occasionally that are non-combatant, which you have the option to attack if you want to. And then the only other people that you encounter are these thugs that'll jump out and try to attack you for no reason.
Yes, they will. And they're too deadly at first. You will get slaughtered and you just kind of have to get used to it. Like the life of the prey, because you're just trying to do runs and just hoping that no one pops out and starts shooting at you, because there's no way to get out of the combat. You can't complete your run because you won't be able to enter any doors. So you just kind of have to just take your bullets. You'll die. And you'll, at this point, you will just respawn at Stoker's Coffin Motel, and I think you lose 10% of your money.
Yeah. So if you have no money, you know, it's not a big loss. But if you got a lot of money, that sucks, man.
It does.
It is a pain early game. I texted you once right after because I was so frustrated, because I just started this game out and I'm literally just trying to go from house to house. And if somebody jumps out, I'm like, okay, I guess I'll just let them. Set the controller down and just take it, man. We'll pick up, try it again. But yeah, anywho. We are on our way to the Jump House to meet Gunderson, which is our local Mr. Johnson, which is the code name for what they call the people that will pay you to do shadow runs.
Yeah, and he's just hanging out in the corner of this this bar, and you approach him, and basically you can ask him for clues, you can ask him about Michael, or at this point you really want to just ask him about work, because he will then offer you a shadow run where there are several types, where you'll have like, there's escort missions where he will tell you to go to a building like the Jackal's Lantern and meet someone here, then escort them to Ares Weapon Emporium. And then you do that, and then the person will pay you and you'll get some karma, and then you come back and get another job.
He has an infinite bag of rinse and repeat fetch quests that you can keep coming back for essentially a random price. And the nice thing too is that if he offers you a job and it's low paying, you can just say no and then turn around and talk to him again, and he'll give you something completely different. So you just wait until you get something that's worth your time.
Of course, your negotiation, you know, the higher the better, because you'll get paid more. And here, you know, Each of these shadow runs you get will give you 1 point of karma, and that sounds very low, and it is, but these are very quick shadow runs. You might not realize it yet, but later, you know, these are all confined to this one area. Later runs that other Johnsons will give you will require cab rides. You travel to a different part of the city, do something, and then come back, and so it's a little longer. Here, they're very fast, and it's you know what it reminds me of is playing like Crazy Taxi.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, you're obviously not driving, but you're just like going, bopping around this little area, going from this place and then this place. Sometimes you will have to deliver a package from one place to another. And there are also what I'll call ghoul runs, where there's an abandoned building, at least one in almost every chunk of the city, where someone will be like, hey, there's an abandoned building, go there and kill ghouls. They're worth 20 new yen apiece, and we'll pay you that much up to a maximum of 20 kills.
Yep, and these are the early game moneymakers. So once you get to a decent level of combat effectiveness with your body and your quickness, intelligence, all that good stuff,
yeah.
And you've got some armor and a gun that you like, these are really the only runs that you want to focus on, at least with Gunderson while you're here in Redmond.
Sure.
Because you can get quite a bit of money fairly quickly doing it.
Definitely, if you get a good price. And early on, I wouldn't go near them. They're not worth it, I think. Too fragile, but... anytime you see a shadow run that you're not interested in, you can just say no, back up, and then try again. And like you said, he'll keep giving you other ones and at different prices sometimes. Like
that is correct. And yeah. Redmond Barons is made up of 11 different houses or buildings that we can enter. And Mr. Gunderson will sort of just randomize, you know, you'll need to go to Boris's greenhouse and pick up so-and-so package. And then you'll need to walk to the rat's nest and drop it off. And then you're paid immediately.
Yeah, yeah. And some are, you know, like right next to the jump house, there's the Jackal's Lantern, which is another bar. And there might not be much going on now, but as you progress in the game, sometimes a shadow runner will just like spawn there and just that's now their new hangout or...
Something I found kind of funny is that Gunderson will give you a run that requires you to go to the jump house, which is the bar that you're in, to pick up a package to take somewhere. And I'm kind of just standing there like, well, can you just give it to me? You really want me to want me to walk outside and come back in? Okay.
You walk out, come back, and then leave. It's pretty funny.
It's worth noting, too, the one other interaction that you can come across while navigating the world, and this is not just confined to Redmond, but the only other people you really come across are these random text box. You'll just be walking along and the screen will cut to a text window, and then you're faced with an interaction with someone, and it can be a variety of different things. And you're essentially either going to be attacked or you're going to be helping someone, or I guess there's like a third like weird encounter where someone will take a picture or something strange will happen that I'm not sure where they're going with that, but
it's very interesting. They appear to be regionally different depending on which chunk of the city you're in. Like here you'll see sometimes a shadowy figure will offer to sell you like some frag grenades and you can accept, or generally in almost all of these you can choose to attack them no matter what, so there's always that. But I wouldn't do that early because you'll probably get killed.
Oh yeah. It is funny that attack is always an option no matter what interaction you get into. It's and you see a man lying face down on the ground, he clearly needs help, attack.
It's interesting, but you know, that's frequently, you know, you'll see someone wounded and you can go to heal them. And sometimes they're just like, thanks, here's 50 new yen. Nice. Sometimes they'll be like, as you get closer, they reveal they're a vampire and attack you, and not so nice. So those frag grenade vendors I was telling you earlier, where I never bought them because we didn't really talk about grenades much, and I'll tell you why, they suck. So it's very awkward to use, and they do splash damage, which can include you and your fellow runners, and not cool.
Yeah, grenades are just there for selling.
Pretty much, but I never did this because I wasn't interested in them. But if you do try to purchase them, sometimes it's an undercover cop, and then now you got to deal with him and you're busted. So
either way, it's they're interesting interactions. I actually liked that part of the game. It's sort of like a random encounter from a normal RPG. So
I love it. It really reminds me of playing tabletop RPGs, because sometimes you just get this weird stuff that it's not very rarely, if at all, is ever connected to the story. It just makes the world feel more lived in and real, you know?
Yeah. And so while we're talking about Redmond Barons, it may sound like we're a little scatterbrained here, but really the bulk of your time in Redmond Barons is doing these runs. I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time here, and it's going to be walking back and forth. It's going to be doing the ghoul runs, headed over to the motel to level up your karma, headed over to the shop to buy new equipment. And that's really what you're doing here. In terms of story, you don't get a whole lot early game.
No, yeah, it's the two shops we have here. You have the Ares Weapon Emporium, where you can buy some guns and armor. So I cannot stress this enough, armor is what you want early on, as well as the Little Chiba's Chop Shop, where that's where you respawn when you die. There it says, it gives you a message where it's like a good Samaritan dragged you in here and they patch you up. But that's where you can buy your cyberware. So a little bit of that is nice, even though it is a bit pricey for the very beginning. The other destinations are mostly just for packages or people, you know, running the various two of them.
Yeah. And again, our goal here is to get 250 new yen to go pay off our brother's debt at Stoker's Coffin Motel, which you get fairly quickly doing maybe four or five Gunderson runs, maybe six. You could probably get that money.
But your typical early price range, you'll get somewhere between like 30 to 60 per run. So,
and it's interesting. I mean, yeah, you spend that 250 new yen. So when I first got that money, I was like, well, I need to get a little extra because I'm not trying to spend all of my money trying to get your brother's stuff. However, when you get your brother's things, you find 500 new yen along with his stuff. Yeah. So you get your money back.
Yeah, which is nice. And but yeah, and when you do that, you also get his cyber deck. So as soon as you get that, and if you have a data jack, you can start messing with the cyberspace if you choose. I believe this is where you also get your weird med alert bracelet or whatever. So now when you die, instead of going to Little Chiba's Chop Shop, you will be taken to the Seattle General Hospital.
Yeah, our first new area.
Which was a big mistake for me. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if I advise you to do this, too, but it was like my first playthrough. I finally saved up and got that, and I'm like, finally, now I can move on. And then it was like I died, and then, oh, no, now I'm in this other chunk of the city. I can't walk back to where I want to be, so you have to take a taxi cab, and that's like 40 new yen.
Yeah, let me ask you this too.
Which is a lot early on, where I was like, I just lost 10% of my money, and sometimes I couldn't even afford it, where I was like, I'm too weak to do any of the runs in this other part of the city. So I realized I went back and restarted to where I was like, all right, I'm gonna level up and power up before I pay off that brother's debt so that I can just, crank them out as fast as I can here.
Yeah, man, I ran into that a lot too, where you would die unexpectedly and then go to Seattle. And then just like you're saying, you're kind of stuck there if you have no money because you got to pay. You can't just walk back to Redmond. It's across the river, so you have to take the taxi. So you're kind of stuck there trying to beg, borrow, and steal, really rely on those random encounters to hopefully get paid a little extra money to take a taxi back to Redmond to do some runs.
Early objective, even though you can't do it here, but I'll bring it up again later. But, there are various gangs throughout the city. Here in the Redmond Barrens, the gang is the Halloweeners. They have a hideout. It's one of your run destinations you can go to. And
the Halloweeners.
All of the gangs that you can either pay money or have a high enough reputation to meet their leader. And you can typically spend more money to give them to where they'll be like, okay, we'll give you a token. And this will mean that, those random people attacking you out on the street are Halloweeners. And if you do that, they'll stop attacking you.
Okay, yeah. Your hands have been stamped, man. You can come and go as you please now.
Yeah, basically. But it's often not worth it. But there's a later gang of orcs that if you do that, they give you their little token. Means that, pretty much all of the taxi drivers are orcs. And they will give you all your rides for free. So that helps a lot.
So I don't know if you know this or not, but if you have 0 new yen, I think you get free taxi rides. Because it happened to me once, and I don't know if it was a one-off, but I had absolutely no money, and I was stuck in a part of the city. I forget where I was. It was somewhere near Seattle. But I tried to take a taxi because I didn't know what to do other than just run around and try to get random encounters to get a little money.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, yeah, I see that you're down on your luck, so this ride's on me. And I was like, oh, what a chum. Thanks,
that's
man.
Nice.
But yeah, I don't know if that happens every time or if it's a one-off.
Like, domo, chum. Well, that's fun. But yeah, so this is your starting area where you kind of, run around. I did a lot of runs here because it's until much later, sadly, and as boring as it may be, it is the most dense karma per real time that you can get. So it's worth it. But once you pay those debts off, then you also, in addition to your cyber deck and med alert, you get some, like, there's a holo picks. You get a couple clues to tell you where to go to investigate in the other parts of the city. And something we haven't mentioned too is on your sub screen, you can go to your like personal assistant. It'll show you a few things like what your current run is, what you got to do if you forget. It'll also show you, it has a clues and hints section, which will show you, whatever the most recent information you've gotten that, I don't know, it kind of tells you where to go in your various little story chains you can go down, which I found very helpful because the story was just these islands in a sea of grinding. So when it's time to go back, I was like, what was I doing? Oh yeah, let's go talk to Owlfeather or Frosty the Elf.
If we didn't have this in the notebook, this game would be exponentially harder because it would be one of those where the heck do I go kind of games. You would have to write down every interaction.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so now we have paid off our dead brother's debts, so we're free to explore Seattle proper and get to the bottom of his untimely murder.
Heck yeah, and real quick before we jump out of Redmond, it's worth mentioning the save system in this game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the save and load game system, you can go into your menu at any time and go to the pocket secretary, and then you've got your save load option. As long as you're not inside an area or like inside a bar or in combat, you can save the game essentially anytime that you want, and it is highly recommended. So yeah. Something that we had talked about offline is that before every run, at the end of every run, I was saving like a madman.
Yes.
And there were
yes.
plenty of times that I got lazy and didn't save and went to go do another ghoul run, and one of the guys with the fedora and the trench coat came out and just destroyed me, and I was like, oh my god. So I have to reload an older save and do a couple runs to catch up.
No, that's super frustrating. I think you only have, what do you have, two files you can save?
Yeah.
Two, so that's nice. It is. I still use some good old-fashioned save states, though. I must fess up. But
same, yeah. But I do like how generous the save feature is in this game, and I do use it often.
Yes, absolutely. And you definitely should early on, because the game has such a high mortality rate that you're going to feel it if you don't, you know?
Yeah, essentially most times that I go to the hospital, I just reload whatever save I had right before, you know, as long as I put that save in before I started the mission.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this week. We will be back next time with some talk about the manual itself, as well as our general chat section, and we will continue our quest around Seattle in the name of poor Michael, R.I.P.
R.I.P. Michael. We're going to get to the bottom of this, brother.
That's right. And if you guys have any tips, this is a very dense, crazy game, and I've done a decent amount of research into it, but there's always more to learn. So if anyone knows any tips or tricks or otherwise, let us know at cartridgecommand@gmail.com. We love to hear from all of our listeners, be ye a street samurai, a decker, or a shaman. We could use tips in all persuasions of Shadowrunner.
Heck yeah, I'm genuinely curious. Hit us up, because this game lends itself to multiple playthroughs and multiple play styles. So it's interesting to see how people choose to go through this.
For sure, yeah. And, you know, you can deck into the internet and let us know also at X or Facebook. Or is that Meta now? I don't know. Or Meta's bigger than that.
just Google Cartridge Command and we'll probably pop up.
Just hit us up, bro. Chums. And last but not least, we must always remember to thank our patrons. It is their Nuyen that keeps us going, keeps the lights on, keeps the mics humming.
Yeah. And shout out again to Radiant Blur for making this episode happen.
Yeah, I legitimately thank you, because I finally gave me the willpower to finally see through the the tough outer shell of this game to get into where I was like, no, there really is a lot of good stuff in here. So thanks again. And as always, Cartridge Commandos,
game on!
Game on!
Game on!
Shadowrun! Right, next up.
Hold on. Sergeant Chillicut.
Chillicut.
Sergeant Mackleman.